Rebel Force Radio presents.
Incoming! No, no, no!
Clone Wars. Declassified.
So, this is where the fun begins.
A roundtable discussion about Star Wars.
The Clone Wars.
Here we go.
Need laser collectors!
Maximum firepower.
Move!
All batteries return fire.
Oh, yes, sir!
Now it's time for Clone Wars. Declassified.
Charged with a crime she did not commit, nothing will ever be the same again for Padawan Ahsoka Tano. Welcome to Rebel Force Radio's Clone Wars Declassified. I'm Jimmy Mack. We're talking Episode 20, Season 5, Star Wars The Clone Wars, the season finale, The Wrong Jedi. Jason Swank couldn't be with us this week, and we're bummed about that, but happy to have along the remainder of what we finally call the A-Team here at Rebel Force Radio, starting with Fanboys director Kyle Newman.
Hey, guys. I am so glad to be here. I am actually the B.A. Baracus of the A-Team, well, although I have no fear of flying.
Well, we could tell just by that hairstyle alone.
Metaphorically A-Team. Yes. Oh, cool.
Metaphorically. So,
there's a lot to talk about, and this has been quite a season, so I know we're going to get into a little bit of everything, but wow, what an episode.
What an episode. What an episode. I can't wait to talk to you about it tonight. And rounding out our esteemed roundtable for this season finale episode of Clone Wars Declassified is Paul Bateman. Paul.
Hey.
Hello,
Star Wars fans. Nice to be here, as always.
Well, it's nice to have you. So let's just jump right into it. We know where we're at here in the series. We know what's been happening. So let's just start right from the beginning. It starts off in the Jedi Council. The Jedi Masters are sitting around looking at that hologram of Tarkin as he is stating his case for why Ahsoka must be tried by the Republic and not the Jedi. So, Kyle, let's just start with you. Were you a little shocked that the Jedi just gave in to this bureaucrat and sort of pushed aside their time-honored traditions and their faith, essentially, so they can abide to the rules of politics that come into play with the Republic?
Well, we've seen them on screen in the films having to put their traditions aside in order to conform to what the Senate and the galaxy and the Republic need. And so we've witnessed them continually selling out their souls piece by piece. This was obviously a very personal, small version of that, in that it affected, you know, the lead character of this series. But it wasn't incongruent with how we've seen them act before. And obviously every situation that they're put in is something that's devised by Palpatine where it's a win-win for him. So in the big picture, and that's something we should get into, is whether or not Palpatine was really behind Barriss or not. But in the big picture, regardless, if the Jedi offer up Ahsoka to them to put on trial, they're selling themselves out. And if perhaps they track down the assassin, the real person and the real terrorist and the real person behind this, and she has the forum to speak, then she's going to speak the truth about them and highlight them as sellouts. So it's a win-win for Palpatine. And I see what he's done is it's really like he's poisoned the Republic, and they were dead before he even revealed himself. This stuff all just played out in a way where just took time for the poison to seep to the head.
Paul, do you think that Palpatine is behind all of the machinations having to do with Barriss and her attack on the Jedi Temple?
I think so. I mean, the thing that this is kind of, these were such deep episodes and so kind of involving that I found myself thinking about the backstory much more than I naturally do. I can be very superficial when it comes to Star Wars and just kind of go, wow, look at that, it's so cool. And not necessarily kind of get into the politics as much as Jason would, for instance. But I found myself looking at this and thinking, the first thing that sort of set me off on this train of thought was basically kind of looking at the Jedi Temple and thinking to myself, kind of almost absentmindedly thinking, do you know, for a place that's supposed to be this kind of spiritual epicenter of the Star Wars universe, it doesn't actually feel that spiritual to me, and it never has. I always kind of expected, you know, back in the OT days that we'd end up in some place that looked like, you know, some Tibetan monastery or something, some place that really kind of felt ancient and felt really kind of mysterious. But perhaps, but less, you know, boardroom, more kind of, you know, ethereal. But then what occurred to me was, you know, like applying, you know, the kind of thinking that you do so often, Kyle, about this kind of thing was, well, why is it like that? And it's obvious that, that Palpatine has been involved in the temple for a very long time. And the reason that maybe it even is that way is probably because he's had his hands in the pie for a long time, even when it wasn't really obvious. So for me, it just kind of feels like he's moving all the pieces around and always has been, you know, and so this episode is no different.
Now, see, I kind of come from a different school of thought when it comes to Palpatine's involvement on Barriss specifically. I really think that Barriss, as is revealed as we get into Act 3 of this episode, when she is standing in front of the court saying that the Jedi become an army fighting for the dark side. She was right with that statement, as we eventually find out in Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, that the Jedi are being manipulated, they're being used to serve the purposes of the dark side. And I kind of got the feeling that when she made that statement and Palpatine quickly got her out of there, take her away, you know, it was almost as if he was trying to shut her up because he realized she was on the right track. And and if she kept down this path of investigation, it could lead her right to Palpatine's office. So I sort of think that this is a unique situation that Barriss, she's introspective. They show her in the episode actually meditating. And we know that Jedi do meditate, but how often do we really see it? But we see her there in front of some weird, funky little Buddha statue. What do you guys make of that little idol she was kneeling in front of? She placed her lightsaber specifically in front of it. Kyle, what do you think that idol was supposed to represent?
Well, I think a lot of Jedis, they bring some of the culture where they came from. Obviously, she has you know, tattoo markings on her face, which aren't necessarily Jedi. So it's part of her culture that's kind of seeped through her character and who she is as a Jedi. So I see that still being part of it. And that's interesting. I mean, that's a conversation of in itself is, it's maybe she's not worshiping a, you know, it's not a Jedi thing, but maybe it's something on her planet that represents a life force, or it's a more ancient way of looking at the force, and it ties her back to who she is. But what you're talking about too, this Palpatine thing, I mean, most likely is that he set a lot of things in motion. And I don't think he directly pulled her aside and fed her information, corrupted her, or had someone do that. I think this is just the indirect result of everything that he's already set in motion. And that's what shows that there's a true power to what he's done, and that the dark side is actually winning at this moment in time in the Star Wars universe. The tide has shifted. The wave is rolling. He doesn't have to do anything. These are the things that are playing out now that he's riding this dark side wave and the galaxy is about to get crushed by it. She is just one of the many beautiful side effects of that, that he could have seen her rear head and be worried when she walked into that room, but then be pleasantly surprised and vindicated that, yes, everything that I have foreseen is happening. Look at the way it's crumbling. Look at the way this situation, which could have gone a totally different way, look at the way it's shaped to elevate and vindicate everything I've done. If anything, it just inspires him to keep going, because he probably had nothing to do with it, but he had everything to do with it because he's the architect of this.
It's a perfect example of the dark side clouding everything.
Exactly.
You know, they're like, being manipulated.
He couldn't have done everything. He couldn't. I mean, it's too arch. It's too simple. I just feel like he's powerful when he puts his faith in the belief that he's right, that the dark side is powerful, and he rides that faith. And that's why I see him the scariest, because it's the belief.
It felt to me like he had to be more involved than we could know, because Otherwise, you know, how could the council be so blissfully unaware of Ahsoka's innocence? You know, I felt like he had to be pushing that knowledge away from them. You know, that there was no way that he's got to be that blind to it. You know,
he may have gotten involved once this reared its head, but I don't know if he necessarily put Barriss up to it and said, "You're going to go to this prison, and here's a key card, and when she's in there talking, you're going to pick her up and choke her to death, and then you're going to run." Like,
yeah, fair enough.
I don't know. I don't think that's what happened. But once this started to play out, he gets his usual suspects. Governor Tarkin, you know, you go handle this. And he makes sure it's going to shape in a way where they can be hung by their own ideals. And rather than him inventing it, plotting it in this Machiavellian way, like, I don't know. I could be wrong, but I don't. And I think if they were going that way, they would have gave us an inkling into that. Star Wars is, I don't think it's ever really understated, nor should it be. It's always, and even if you are doing something underhanded or with subterfuge, you draw attention to it with a wink. That's just Star Wars. And they didn't do that in this to let us know that this was Palpatine's design, but I'm sure he shaped it to another victory.
Mm. You know, he's the ultimate puppet master, and sometimes he's successful when he's not even holding the strings. It might not necessarily be Palpatine directly being involved in Barriss and her, for lack of a better term, rebellion against the Jedi Order, but he's indirectly involved because he is the one who sowed those seeds, and now he's just enjoying the fruits of his labor.
You know, Jimmy, it harkens back to Pawn Krell and the questions there. Was this somebody who was targeted because he was having second thoughts about the Jedi by Palpatine and rendered a disciple because of that? Or is this just a Jedi who'd grown disillusioned and then Palpatine seized the situation? Because are these things just the signposts that say, wow, I'm winning the war? Because look, another Jedi fell. And what, this girl, this young ideal girl, like somebody who's probably on her way to a good career as a Jedi, look at her. She just lost her faith. She lost her way. These are the things that that makes him know he's winning. Because I don't know if he was directly involved in Krell. I don't know if that was ever clearly stated. I don't know if he was ever really the mastermind behind Barriss's change of heart. Because it feels like she's coming from a very real place. And everything she says is completely 100% true from a certain point of view. So I mean, we know the Jedi in their hearts are not bad people, but sometimes good people do the wrong thing or don't realize that there's another option. And that's what's happening to the Jedi. And that's, I mean, he crafts, like the puppet master, win-win situations for himself. It's just, how do you want to hang yourself is the scenario he gives you.
Yeah. He'll give you just enough rope and you can hang yourself. You know, jumping ahead to when Barriss faces off against Anakin and when it all really starts hitting the fan for her. You bring up Krell, and he seemed to be devoted to the dark side. And I assumed it was Count Dooku who was getting to Krell. I don't know if we talked about that when we analyzed those episodes, but I thought he was influenced by Dooku more than anything. I don't think Barriss had given herself necessarily to the dark side. I don't think she actually crossed that line. I got worried when she had Ventress's sabers and Anakin called her out for that.
She said, "They suit me."
She said, "I think they suit me." Yeah, that's right. That's right. But
she didn't have yellow eyes, but no, nor did Krell.
No, of course. And of course, Anakin didn't either, except for one brief moment in the film, one or two brief moments.
Dooku didn't have yellow eyes either, did he?
So. Right.
It's true.
Right.
So I don't know if that's a standard, but then Grievous did have yellow eyes, and he was not. So who knows?
Yeah,
I bet Barriss and Pawn Krell, maybe they did have little secret meetings. You bring the pie, I'll bring the soda. Let's conspire.
But see, I don't think Barriss sold her soul to the dark side. I think she was fighting it. I think in her speech at the end of the episode, when she was standing in front of that jury, she said that she feared the Jedi had become an army fighting for the dark side. So she was trying to stop that, and the only way she knew how to stop violence was with more violence.
Dooku didn't leave, though, because Dooku left just like them. He's like one of them, but Palpatine got the Dooku. So that's why I look at it. They're like Dooku or Krell or Barriss. They're all very similar.
Paul, what do you think? Did Barriss sell her soul to the dark side, or was she trying to stand up for what she believed is right?
I mean, I kind of feel as though if her statement was true at the end of the episode, if that's genuinely what she felt, and it seemed to me as though that was sincerely what she was thinking, then I don't think she saw that as a dark side act. I think she had genuine concerns, and I think it was a better story for it, because it's like these, if you can compare these movies where the bad guy has no real motivation other than kind of taking over the world or whatever, you don't really kind of care. But when the bad guy's motives kind of make sense, it suddenly becomes more interesting and more grey. And for me, I think they made it quite clear that her intentions were good. And I think that maybe that her means of kind of, fixing everything up were so extreme that they could definitely be kind of considered dark side acts. But I think it was just a sheer act of desperation. And who knows, what's really kind of driven her to see the world that way. I mean, obviously she knows, she has some suspicions that what we all know as viewers is going on. But what that is and why she knows that, we don't know. But I think she definitely thought she was doing the good thing, even though she was running around murdering lots of clones and dropping people in trouble. But
you know what I did this weekend was I watched that episode from season 2, Brain Invaders, that featured Ahsoka and Barriss. And essentially this was the last time we really had an episode featuring Barriss prior to this story arc. And they have an interesting conversation, the two of them. They're on board the blockade runner, and they're in the mess hall having a bite to eat. And they start discussing philosophically what the Jedi role is during the war, and what is it going to turn into after the war. And Ahsoka said, well, we'll just be peacekeepers after the war. We won't be warriors anymore. We'll be peacekeepers. And Barriss says, well, what's the difference? And I thought that was kind of interesting that they were showing doubt within Barriss going way back to season 2. So that might be something that you would want to look into if you're trying to understand her character's motivation a little bit. Also, those brain worms must have done a number on her.
I was going to say, did anybody get a peek of a worm?
Right. Did it? Yeah. In this episode, did anybody see any worms coming out of her ears or anything? No. It would be funny if she sneezed and a worm, came flying out. Everyone looked at her.
Well, there's a giant one in the wardrobe. Kind of, shh.
So, it's just kind of an interesting flashback to go check out that Brain Invaders and listen to that discussion and put it into the context of this episode. And you start to understand these idealistic ways that Barriss had, much like Dooku. Dooku just simply walked away from the order, presumably standing behind the fact that he was a political idealist. We know that is not true at all. He was actually under the sway of the dark side. But I don't feel like Barriss was under the sway of the dark side. I believe that she was acting on her political idealistic views, and that is what forced her to take such extreme actions, because she felt that violence was the only way to combat the situation they were in. She had to make a big noise about it, so to speak. So she orchestrates everything perfectly in a very dark side kind of way to frame Ahsoka. Kyle, is it safe to say that Barriss is the one who left that key card for Ahsoka so she could escape from prison in the first place?
I would say yes, because they never indicated it could be anyone else at all. So I feel like the scenario was set up to ensnare Ahsoka. Yeah. But well, the one thing, I mean, it has to be simple in this way, but Barriss might have these very honest and real observations, but it is duplicitous and almost disingenuous to be the person preaching about them if you're going to these extreme lengths to frame someone who you know is good and who's your friend. Is that the best way to do it? And maybe that is what lends credence to the idea that she did go to the dark side. On top of that line, which I think has to bear a lot of weight, I think the suit me, referring to double red lightsabers, mm-hmm. There was a brashness to it, a cockiness that's also synonymous with Sith. So, you know what I mean? It's like for someone who has, that thinks they're better than that, that thinks the Jedi have stooped to a new low and she doesn't want to be a part of them, to then go be so deceitful to throw your friend under the bus and frame her every step along the way, also shows that you're no better, which is pretty commonplace with Sith to think they're better, but to really make all the mistakes that everyone else makes. So I don't know. That's my observation. And it may just come down to just that's the way you had to plot it to make the story work, to have these twists. I know I listened to all the previous roundtables you guys did on this. And I know, Jimmy, you were pretty vocal about being upset it truly was Barriss.
Yeah. I mean, just from a storyteller standpoint.
And I know. But when we compare it, like Jason said, you know, compare these to Hitchcock, and I hope there's better plotting, and I hope there's a bigger twist. But the thing is, even CSI, which you guys were comparing it to, which they obviously tried to compare this to, which I thought was one of the weaker parts of this, Star Wars doesn't need to cater and pretend to be anything else. Star Wars is its own genre. So I hope that as this show goes forward, and anyone else making Star Wars, if you're listening to this, learn your lesson. It's an amalgamation of a bunch of things, but you don't need to be so obvious about your reference. I felt they've done this a little bit too much this season. And a few times, those are the moments where I'm like, you don't need to do that. You could do it, but hide it a little better. You don't have to name the episode that. And then you're kind of being forcing comparisons. But those shows, CSI and the Hitchcock stuff that they reference, they don't also have an overarching villain. It's not like you'd reveal the guy at the end. It's the thug from down the corner named Guido. And then you're like, oh, but Guido's working for a Sith master. You know, there's no extra layer to it.
Right.
They end. They're episodic. They're self-contained. They reach resolution. There's fulfillment purely out of solving the mystery with your main character, being a step behind or feeling like you're a step ahead and being toyed with and played with. And that's the enjoyment of the experience. This has to fit into a much larger picture. Larger picture we've always talked about and craved, which is the overplot of Palpatine and the Sith and what they're doing and how they're undermining the Jedi. So this, it has to play to that too. And so that's why I don't judge it purely as a comparing it to how a CSI or a Hitchcock movie is scripted or, mm-hmm. you know, thriller mystery.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up.
I think this serves something bigger too. And on that level, I'm completely satisfied. And yeah, it could have been more complex with Barriss, but I don't think it was disheartening. So did you feel it was, knowing that it was telegraphed, did you feel like it was didn't live up to its snuff once it was revealed on screen for you?
Well, as far as being a mystery, yeah, of course, because it was so obvious that it was Barriss.
True.
But
there was one person, there was one suspect.
Right.
And Asajj.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what TV show I used to watch all the time, and I always knew the first person they suspected
Murder,
the
She Wrote?
Guilty one. I can't remember which one it was. But
Columbo? Scooby-Doo?
Yeah, Scooby-Doo, of course, you meddling kids. But I'm glad you bring that up about the influence that certain things have had on episodes of The Clone Wars, where we have seen the Hitchcock, and we've seen other things being reflected in these scripts. And me and Jason are critical about that. And by voicing that criticism, we receive some criticism in return from loyal Rebel Force Radio listeners who would get on our butts because they would say, well, you guys say Star Wars shouldn't be influenced by this or that or these outside stories, but the original Star Wars was totally influenced by Flash Gordon, old Westerns, Kurosawa films, etc. Now, I
right,
say
but
this.
It did it in a new, fresh way that was it was a healthy amalgamation. It's screwball romantic. It happened one night. It's samurai. It's Western. It's pulp. It's serial. It's science fiction. It's fantasy. Yes, it's all of them. But it does it in equal parts to make it something new. When you just say, I'm going to go make a Star Wars CSI episode, that's where you're dangerous. And I know I love the show because it's experimental. And it's also – its low points are when it's – it deviates from Star Wars to be specifically a genre that's not Star Wars. Star Wars is its own genre, and it always needs to be true to that. Yeah, it's fun to do this, and it's experimental, but those are the speed bumps in the series. And I'm not saying this was that. I thought this was well-scripted. Yeah, it could have been a less obvious choice, and maybe there could have been – if you have four episodes – this was four episodes, so it could have been maybe paced a little differently, but – maybe you had room to put another red herring in the Jedi Temple, and that leads to a dead end, and then it's like, who could it be? And then the only way to get information is to go to Ventress. And I wanted to feel like maybe Anakin, he left her too easily. This is someone who he's been after forever. It should have been negotiated more that she would live another day, that he wouldn't kill her because I just gave you this information. Instead, it's like, see you later. Yeah, see you later. See you in a week. Yo. Fist pump. It was too easy. Like, he was like, yeah, I'll be back maybe. I was like, this is someone you've been hunting for five seasons and a micro series, dude. You'd be chopping her head off.
What do you think, Paul?
Or you'd bring her in and say, you're coming to answer until I figure this out. You don't just be like, yeah, have fun in the underworld. See you in a week.
What do you think, Paul? Was she let off too easy?
I think maybe, you know, there could be more to that than meets the eye, because, I mean, although that makes perfect sense to me, Carl, because I can never fault your logic when it comes to plotting, because you're good at it. But, like, at the same time, you know, you look at Asajj, as you used to call her, you know, you could say that Anakin is kind of thinking, well, I can read that your intentions have changed. You know, he could be maybe picking up on something that's not discussed. So perhaps he has a reason, and his momentum is leaning forward. So maybe he doesn't feel he has.
I agree. But if Anakin picks up on it, then you have to let the audience know that Anakin's picked up on it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? How do I know what Anakin's picked up on it without me getting on a podcast with you guys and speculating? And we're not the average people. We're ill. We have problems. We're on a Star Wars podcast. The average person just watched it, consumed it like it was a bucket of popcorn, and is done with it.
Yeah.
But then you could say
the average person.
Because it's only 20 minutes.
You have to make sure it works for those people. I'm just saying it could have been a couplet of dialogue, where he's like, cool, I got what I want, now I'm taking you in. And she just cleverly negotiates her way out of it in a way where he's like, it's a good point. Okay.
But then maybe
Then he says his threat.
Maybe the average audience member wouldn't necessarily notice, Carl, you know, at the same time. I mean, what I would say is, you know, given what you were just saying there, Jimmy, about, you know, when they borrow from other shows and stuff, I would have said that the episode 18, The Jedi Who Knew Too Much, was probably one of the most kind of, you know, derived from a obvious kind of Hitchcock reference kind of episode that you could have. And yet for me, it was definitely among the top sort of three or four episodes I've ever seen of The Clone Wars. I thought it was an amazing episode.
I agree. Yeah, I love that episode.
By the end of that episode, I literally wanted to stand up and applaud. It was so good. Which very, very rarely happens to me, and I watch so many movies and TV shows, thousands and thousands and thousands. But you know, you've got to applaud them for the fact that in a 20-minute show where they have no time to essentially tell a story, I mean, what can you literally tell in 20 minutes? It's such a short period of time that they managed to kind of, you know, involve me so much in these characters and make me feel for these characters in a way that many exceptional actors can disappoint. You know, I mean, there have been many, many Oscar-winning actors I can think of who've turned out performances where they just fall flat and just don't move me, you know. And yet this collection of pixels, you know, that's put together by this team of people is managing to sort of really make me feel and emote. So I think what they've achieved with this arc is incredible. I think it's absolutely astonishing the level to which they've taken this. And the one thing I would say to people about this who aren't necessarily kind of involved in the film industry or the television business in any way is you don't get quality like this just by paying people a lot of money and standing back and watching. The only way you get quality like this is because everybody cares, everybody loves it, and everybody's prepared to stop looking at the clock and just put in the hours and just keep banging away at stuff, and nobody wants to let a thing go until it's wonderful. And there are thousands of things in these episodes that any number of people could have said, you know what, I'm not going to bother with that. That's a pain, and nobody's going to notice it. Well, I noticed the millions of things in these episodes, including like hand animated sparks when Ahsoka's fighting away her pursuers, you know, that just gave it a really unique sort of look that I hadn't seen before, and millions of other little things, you know, where you just kind of think, God, that looks so realistic or so believable, and the micro expressions and sort of subtle acting in these characters is just astonishing, and somebody had to labor over those for hours, and these people, you know, they, the fact that, you know, that there's any, I mean, I won't go there too far, but like the fact that there's any question about this show's kind of continuance for me is preposterous, because it's, as far as I'm concerned, I know it's kind of quite clear that I'm a massive Star Wars fan like the rest of you guys, but I mean this straight from the heart. I think it's the best thing on television at the minute, and it deserves everybody's respect and admiration. And the people that make this show, I have to say, the nicest thing I can say about this is that there have been times I was never really truly a prequel hater. However, you know, I genuinely had to learn to enjoy the prequels. And there were times and moments, and there are still things that I find difficult to kind of justify as a Star Wars fan to people when you know, the common complaints, which I won't repeat. But for me, I think that this show has achieved something in that it's made this Star Wars fan really proud to be a Clone Wars fan. I think that what they've achieved is something that's so special. There's absolutely no shame in watching this show at all, because I think it's just such spectacular television that it really deserves a larger audience, and it deserves a greater success than it's achieved. And you know, for whatever reason, that's the case. I think it's unfair, because this show is just, when it's at its best, it's just the most incredible show. And
it's not down to anything that Dave and Joel and all of the writers have contributed, or the actors.
Yeah.
They've done, this isn't just a good television show. This isn't a good Star Wars show. This is a great television show, period, regardless. You could stick this on any time of night.
Absolutely.
And I think people, more people knew it was on, they would be blown away. They would not only be blown away, they'd be shocked at how good it is. Because I don't think people realize, there are Star Wars fans I know, living, breathing Star Wars fans, that are like, should I check that out? Mm. I'm like, you're wearing an X-Wing shirt, you idiot. Why are you not watching this? What is wrong with you? You're buying Gentle Giant crap and you're not watching the Clone Wars? Uh-huh. Are you? I mean, can't even talk to you.
I mean,
how do you not know? Every episode adds another dimension to the movies. Like, I mean, everything that Dave's done, it's just like there's so much care, so much thought. Look at this. Look at this right here. In screenwriting and storytelling, you often do things in threes. And look at Ahsoka. We're always like saying, is it going to be, is she going to die or is she going to live? And we always thought it was going to be one of the two. And you look at Anakin's life and there's loss. And loss is the thing that drives him. Attachment, fear of losing, and actually losing. And it happened with his family. And that's, you know, his mother. That's the family. In work, it's been Ahsoka. And in love, it's been Padme. And those are the three steps. And now we've seen one, two, and three. And yeah, there's room for this series to still grow with her not part of the Jedi Order and doing her own thing and going off with Lux, and who knows what's going to happen, because they find some more commonality now. But I don't think this means the series is over in any way, you know, intellectually, philosophically, plot-wise, whatever. The series has so much more room to go. This is a new tangent, a new direction. It's healthy that they made this choice. But this is one of the losses, great losses of Anakin Skywalker's life. And this adds so much dimension to what happens in Revenge of the Sith, and adds more context when you look back to episode one and how they mined that to set up who Anakin is and to explore him. And he's the same person. We're just seeing more nuanced version of character study of Anakin. That's what the show is. And that's what people always said. Well, the movies happened too quickly. And
yeah.
Pulled off too big of a story. Well, this is that story. It's on television every week, folks. It's like, if you're listening to this, obviously you know, but I'm just shocked that there are people out there that don't.
Carl,
and Star Wars fans, go out there and be vocal and make sure that people see this.
Carl, can I ask you a question? Obviously, as a director, you've had to set up, you know, emotional exchanges between two actors and make it feel real. You know, I mean, obviously, a lot of the time, you know, I guess much of the work of the director comes at the casting stage, where you just pick the right people who you know can pull it off. But I mean, you must have, you know, seen exchanges between actors and just thought, not really feeling it. You know, like it's not really necessarily kind of portraying the emotion that you're hoping to kind of get from it, or
even on paper, when you think people should work or they worked, when you rehearsed it, sometimes it's just, what is the mindset that day? What did they go through that night that you don't know? And how do you bring them back to that point?
Well, you know, taking that into account and the fact that obviously when you watch movies, you must have seen exchanges like that too, where you kind of left a little nonplussed. I mean, what astonished me about this whole arc was, you know, the exchanges between Barriss and Ahsoka when they were walking through the corridor, the subtle kind of, you know, inferences between the two of them, and the you know, the thoughts that were passing behind their eyes, and the exchanges between Anakin. I mean, especially with the Braid situation, which, you know, is jumping ahead slightly, with Anakin and Ahsoka, that whole exchange was just such an amazing performance. The way you could feel what those characters were feeling and be moved by it. As two animated characters, I mean, you must know as well as anybody does how next to impossible that is to achieve.
It's powerful. It's harder, I think, with animation because it's inanimate. So anytime you can elicit real emotion, and that was an emotional end, and those are character moments. And you can have things flash and blur and, you know, recreate great lightsaber fights or laser blasts and show off spectacle. But when it gets down to it, no matter animation, live action, when it's an emotional moment, there's nothing there. There's no special effects other than the human emotion and the human experience. And that's what they were able to showcase. And Dave specifically, who directed this one, you know, it was a beautiful scene in that it's Star Wars and there's always all these other things, but that, and it's at its core, Star Wars is best when it works on big character, emotional levels. Mm. And that delivered in spades. And so I said, you know, regardless of any little nitpicks I had throughout these four episodes, and look, I'm on the show, I have to come up with stuff to talk about. I can't just say it's awesome all the time.
That's right.
Because realistically, I'd go out there and I'd tell everyone I know it's awesome all the time, but I can come here on with you guys and say, maybe it needed an extra line here. And sometimes I feel, you know, disingenuous doing it because I love it, but we just have to analyze it. And of course, you can always nitpick and make something better and backseat drive. And it's kind of what you do on Declassified, and if you're analyzing this stuff, you just break it down and talk about Star Wars and what it means to you. But that moment made up for everything because it showed that they took the show in honest direction and they made a choice to say, you know what, she's going to go with a leap of faith. And you know what, it would have felt wrong for her to go back in there, because what worried me was how big it was staged, that they had all the Jedi Masters there. They're all apologizing. They go outside and there's almost like the second ending. And the second ending sometimes what happens, really, it's the end of a season or it's the end of a show. Even the music was different for the end credits. And I know it's not totally uncommon because they've done different opening colors and they've experimented before. But the fact that this was orchestrated, you know, with a live orchestra, that they did a different end theme, that there was this double ending, that it was this type of precipice that she was put on and she made this leap. I mean, in a way, it feels like, wow, it could end right now. I hope it doesn't. I don't think it's going to. You'd never know because we don't know what Disney's planning. So I hope people, like Jimmy, you've been saying, be vocal. I totally agree with you. Is you need to let the people behind Star Wars know how you want Star Wars to look.
Absolutely. And we're recommending.
You need to get out there and say, this is Star Wars. I love it. This is great. And why keep this and give me some episode 7? It's not one or the other. What's going on here? Wake up. This is great. Let them know that you love this.
Of course, we're recommending that listeners leave us voicemails. We're putting together a CD that we're actually going to send to Bob Iger. So if he has the time, he'll be able to listen to passionate Star Wars
fans. Regardless of what Disney's doing, it doesn't hurt to let them know how special this show is and how beloved it is.
Great
work you think everyone's doing on it. So that's important. But I will say, you know, some of those things, the way I heard they re-recorded the dialogue, and that's not uncommon either. But they did two versions of it. Was one the version where the season could keep going and she stays, and was one the version where she she quits. I don't know. I don't know if this was all part of something else.
Right, right, right. A la Empire Strikes Back with the reveal, right. I am your father.
You always craft it in a way so you leave the door open and you don't know. And obviously they were finishing this season in a vacuum, not knowing. Well, we don't know if they know, but Cartoon Network didn't. You know, we knew that they weren't bringing the show back and no new home was announced post-Disney acquisition. So we don't know the fate of the show. And there we watched the last episode and we still don't have answers. So should you be concerned? Absolutely. Should you be vocal? If you love the show, yeah. Do you want to see more? Then tell them. What does it take? 30 seconds?
I think
you'd rather write a letter for 30 seconds or complain for 2 years that they took away your home. Yeah, exactly. Wake up. Write a letter.
I think something that you know, certainly, especially for female listeners and fans, you know, when was the last time that you saw two female characters that you just thought were fantastic take out 20 guys who were armed and you bought it? Mm-hmm. I mean, for that matter, when was the last time you saw that at all? I mean, it almost never happens in any kind of television fiction. The other thing is, you look at Ahsoka as a 13-year-old kind of girl or whatever she was when the show started. You know, as a guy in his 40s, you know, when this began, you know, I'd be kind of looking at it thinking, really? I heard about the fact that it was going to be a young female character. And although I consider myself very open to female characters in fiction, I still found myself kind of going, oh, I really don't know about that. I'm not sure if that's something that I want to watch. And that really is down to the fact that we just don't get it done to a high enough standard, I think, because the bottom line is, you know, here's a grown guy rooting for Ahsoka like no other character in Star Wars at the moment, and really, really concerned and wanting to know what her fate is, and really kind of care about her as a person in a way that easily compares to any kind of like male lead in any other fiction, you know, easily compares. And Ahsoka is important to me, you know, because her character is so well-rounded, so real, and she's so likable, you know. I mean, there's just the fact that she happens to be a little girl is almost irrelevant, you know, because she's just so real, and it's like a family member that you all care about. So I think that, you know, even that on its own is something worth fighting for, because we just, you know, there isn't enough of that out there. You know, it's always the same sort of scenario, and this is, you know, Star Wars is always trying to break the mold a little, regardless of how much it's kind of borrowed from other things. But it's always tried to kind of push the envelope. I mean, everybody knows when every film is released, there's at least one scene that you kind of go, oh, I've never seen anything like that before. Or it's just done to a level that, you know, degree that you've never seen anything with that kind of spectacle. But, the Clone Wars is a quieter story sometimes and a more gradual story because it can afford to be that. And it's kind of playing to its strength with episodic television. You want kind of in-depth characterization. You want it to be protracted. You know, you want to care about these people. And I just think Ahsoka is just such a fantastic character. And for me, I kind of feel that her story, although this episode may have kind of rounded things up in a nice kind of, you know, bow to a certain extent, you know, I still feel as though there's a lot more to say about Ahsoka. I think I haven't had enough of that character, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who feel the same way. I mean, I remember we've spoken many times off air about the Mortis trilogy, because that was such a sort of significant moment in the sort of Star Wars canon. I'm sure we all remember the fact that Ahsoka, died and was brought back to life essentially by sister, was it, of the Mortis family? Although that kind of threw things out of balance, cosmically speaking, for the Force. So for me, I've always felt that Ahsoka at some point would walk away from the fight and return to Mortis in some point and be in some way instrumental in restoring the balance, in the same way that, you know, Anakin is kind of predicted as being a guy who would kind of bring balance to the Force. I feel that Ahsoka had the same kind of job, but in a different way. She had to return and just kind of balance the energy in the universe or some such thing. If you remember that episode, you'll know what I'm talking
sure,
about.
Of course.
But what's interesting to conjecture too is, who would Ahsoka be if she wasn't paired with Anakin? And was she paired with Anakin to help him, or vice versa? I mean, or was it a mutually beneficial thing that Yoda foresaw? Why he picked Ahsoka? Like, Anakin brought her out of her shell, and she also gets Anakin in a way that few people do. And they have this really unique relationship. Anakin doesn't have a relationship with anyone else like he does with her. not even Padme. I mean, it's not even Obi-Wan. It's a very unique thing, and I think it's a mutually beneficial thing, and Yoda probably had a vision and thought it would work, and obviously it changed the course of the galaxy. But it's interesting to see the way one person can influence a character, and what's fascinating is to see the effect that Ahsoka has now had on Anakin and the decisions he makes going into episode 3, and just looking at the end where he says, you know, what he feels, and she says, I know you have, with his, you know, idea of leaving the Order. And, you know, we know he's having his own crisis of faith because of how it was handled. He's seen firsthand the way his own mentors have let someone down he cared about, and next we're going to see them let him down in Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that, Carl, to me is the idea that if we hadn't seen Revenge of the Sith, we would still be wondering, you know, like that act, could that result in Anakin's, you know, being saved by somehow being disenfranchised with the Jedi? Could, or, you know, but obviously we know that's not the case. Or would that be the reason that he fell, which is the way it kind of turns out? But yeah, I mean, I kind of felt that when she went, it became really kind of clear how important she was to Anakin, and then kind of conversely, how important she is, full stop. It's like
it was an important strike against them, and you could see, you know, Mace Windu in the last episode, what he said, and how he didn't want Anakin to actually go. It was a precursor to him not wanting Anakin to be involved with the apprehension of Palpatine. I don't know. It always adds a dimension, and that's why this show is great. You know, it's not going off on some tangent 2,000 years from now or 2,000 years in the past about something that doesn't matter. It's not regurgitating stuff we know, but sticking different striped pants on it. It relates to the movies, and that's what this is. Star Wars is a movie franchise. Everything else supports that. This is like cinematic television. It's as close as you can get to.
Don't you think, you know, as well that, like, you know, when you watch, I mean, especially, you know, a couple of the episodes here, we had an aerial dogfight that was comparable with a movie, and we had the whole chase scene for me was just, I would have been so satisfied seeing that as a film.
Those were fantastic scenes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, don't you feel that in itself is an achievement? That for me, the highest praise I can give this is to say that this is real Star Wars. And I'm sure lots of fans kind of know what I mean by that. But this feels kind of like it's genuinely a part of the Star Wars universe now, and it's taken a long time for them to get there. But
they're bridging the gap with the way the interior and the corridors looking. Even the detention cell looks so much like a Death Star cell,
right,
and
yeah.
Everything kind of.
What I was getting at there, Carl, was like,
together.
That's not easy to achieve. I mean, nobody else is out there making Star Wars movies or movies that even come close to it. But they've managed to pull that off on a TV show. And I'm sure a lot of that is through George's input. But, you know, it's taken a long time for that team to kind of get to the point where they're able to make something on television that feels like real Star Wars. And that, in my mind, that isn't something you should just throw away on any level. I think it deserves to keep going, Clone Wars, because
I think people will continue to discover the show regardless.
I'm sure they will.
More seasons or not. I think as new movies come out, people are always going to go back, discover this, and realize that this is a vital chapter in the Skywalker tale.
Absolutely.
I mean, it says so much. And you know what? One thing we always talk about, Dave, and Dave personally directed this episode too, I believe, and it's a fantastic episode, but you know, we talk about Joel's spectacular lighting and the cast, but, you know, Cary Silver is the producer. And what his job is to do is to make sure that Dave and all the creative people have exactly what they need and deliver so they can bring to life what's in their head. And I met Cary before many times. He's a great guy and a creative guy. And he doesn't get all the central praise. But when you look at where the show started and then you look at where it is now and what they're able to pull off production-wise and the scope of it and how many planets we go to and how we're seeing new corners and nooks and areas of the galaxy we never thought we'd see, that's down to the creative producing of it. So, I mean, that's the end of season 5, and look at where the show has grown. That's like no small feat, and that comes down to just really passionate and creative producing. So that's fantastic, and I'm happy that, you know, they pulled this off to give us this kind of spectacle. And also the writing, I, you know, I thought this arc was great. It's Charles Murray, and like I said, yeah, it's Star Wars. It's not literally a CSI. It has to service the big picture. And when you get to the end of this episode, you realize, okay, I didn't need it to work as the most twisty-turny whodunit. I needed it to serve the purpose of where we get to at the end, where she has a forum to step up and tell the Jedi exactly what they are and tell the truth, and for Anakin to feel it and for Ahsoka to lead. That's the point of this. It's not to just send us on this sinewy, serpentine mystery. That's part of it. But it had to get somewhere, which is what I was saying before. Those other shows don't need to get somewhere bigger. So we need to save that space. That's what the decision they made. We need to make sure it goes and builds toward this message, which then relates to movies, relates to a bigger picture, relates to a saga of storytelling. So I think when you look at it in that macro level, it was a fantastic job of writing these to service the bigger need. Still being fully adrenalized, like we said, that opening sequence of this where there's that dogfight, that was amazing.
Yeah.
Mm. And that chase where she's knocking down stun blasts was fantastic.
Yes. And it felt very Star Wars too. It's very easy for us to look at the things like environments and vehicles and wardrobe and things, but what really makes it feel like Star Wars to me is my attachment to the characters, and the characters feel like they belong in this universe. Specifically talking about Ahsoka, I told Ashley Eckstein this week on Rebel Force Radio that Ahsoka is kind of like the Star Wars little sister. Us fans want to protect her. We want to be the surrogate Anakin for Ahsoka in any situation she's in. So when they march her into that Chamber of Judgment, which, by the way, if any of our listeners have a death metal band, I think that would be a great name for an album, Chamber of Judgment. Yeah.
Definitely.
And they have those cool Jedi temple guards with their yellow sabers. Rocked
it. If I don't see somebody in fancy dress in that gear,
That was the first on-screen yellow saber,
that's
correct?
Right. Yeah, the first
canon saber.
The first canon yellow lightsaber. So we'd seen yellow sabers before in the comics and maybe video games, what have you. But this is the first time we actually saw in a legitimate...
Now, what are those guys?
Now, they're
what do you guys think? Is that something you do like... you're the newbie. You got to be the Jedi Academy guard for a while.
Well, possibly. Filoni does talk about this on the featurette at StarWars.com. He does address who these Jedi Temple Guards are and why they wear the masks. Essentially, they are Jedi, and they get rotated in and out of
these
shifts.
That's what
it felt
like. Yeah. Okay.
They get rotated in and out of these shifts, and they wear those masks to protect their identity, to keep them anonymous. So,
it wouldn't help Yoda.
Like, sure.
Hey, look at that little guy.
One should have looked just like Yaddle, you know?
Or who's the guy we used to get pizza? What's his name? That guy.
Yuriel Poof.
Yuriel Poof.
Yeah, Yuriel Poof. You'd be like, I think I know you.
I know it's you, dude. Take off the mask. No, it's not.
But so those guys were cool. And so they march Ahsoka into this Chamber of Judgment. She goes up there on the platform. And it just seemed to me that the hard evidence against her was not there. It was all circumstantial at best. There was no hard proof that she was the one who was responsible for this bombing. However,
there was video
of her choking Leta. Okay, it looked as if she was choking Leta, but she wasn't, as we know. But that's just how it appeared on the video. Mm. So, and, you know, conveniently, the audio was missing. But in the scene before, Stacey Tin said, just because of the fact that she was caught with these nano droids, that was enough to convict her. And again, I think it's just circumstantial at best. What do you think, Kyle? I mean, do they have the hard evidence against Ahsoka? I didn't see it.
No, they didn't. But I think at the point that she – look, we know the people voting on this, they're – you don't think they've been handpicked by Palpatine? At least in a – at least he handpicked enough to know that he always has the vote he needs. So they're – even if they're not corrupt, he knows they share sensibilities that will yield the results he wants.
Well, I'm specifically talking about the fact that the Jedi – turned her over to the Republic. The Jedi, Mace Windu himself said, we believe you're guilty of these crimes. So.
Oh, well, yeah. There is the momentum of this. And if they were looking at this in a vacuum saying, well, what's the best thing? They would have deliberated for a while and they could have got to the bottom of it. But Palpatine puts a gun to their head and demands a decision by way of Tarkin and knows that they are in a precarious position where if they hold out, they look defiant and they're hanging themselves. And, you know, he knows that they're going to feel like sellouts if they hand her over, but he's created, you know, a scenario has created itself because of all his interventions where they're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't, you know. It's so, and I think the Jedi, in a sense, they know that. Yoda even says it's hard to see, you know, because the vision, the clarity they would have normally had isn't there for them. And, you know, even Ahsoka, she doesn't help herself. She doesn't say, well, wait a second. Here's what happened with Ventress. She says, yeah, I was hanging out with her.
Yeah, that
she
seems
really
to be,
like, give a really good argument for herself.
Right,
she,
right.
Hold on a second.
Just this the fact that happened. She associated with Ventress really seemed to be something that contributed.
I'm trying to stay alive because you've sent people to shoot me.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? I'm trying to show you guys that it's not me. She was a necessary evil because I know that it's not me and I'm trying to show to you who it is. Instead, she kind of just like lets them accuse her of chilling with Ventress.
I thought she was going to have a go at Padme for being a rubbish defense because it was like, hang on a minute.
I thought she was good.
I just looked like, where's Padme been for half a season? And then I realized I didn't really care because compared to like Asajj and Padme, Asajj and Ahsoka, I thought that she's such a beige character now. I mean, I felt the defense was really, she went back into robot mode, you know. She did not kill anybody.
And what was with that weird headdress she was wearing? It kind of gave her those Princess Leia Alderaan hair buns, but made out of metal. It was
when did Tarkin get his legal degree?
That's right. We didn't know he was an attorney at law.
But why don't they do like a Judge Judy episode? Since they're so keen on doing like referencing. Judge Wapner could have presided. They could have done Night Court. Star Wars meets Night Court.
Coruscant Court. But yeah, I just thought that the evidence presented against her was circumstantial at best. There didn't seem to be any real hard evidence against her. And
but then again, we can't look at this like it's a crime show.
Right, right.
Because if it's a crime show, then yeah, it would have been there. It would have been... Yeah. Nuanced in, and they would have had those beats, but we have to look at this as this was a device to service a big emotional message at the end. It was a device to service a platform so Barriss could offer her damnation of the Jedi. This wasn't an episode to make the best courtroom scene in Star Wars. Because Star Wars shouldn't have courtroom scenes that are taken literally. Star Wars should not have whodunit mysteries that are taken literally. Mm-hmm. It should be to serve greater thematic stuff, and you can hint at it, and you can go for it, but that's not exactly literally what it should ever be. Like, A New Hope wasn't Star Wars, the hidden Death Star,
right,
instead of the hidden fortress, even though it borrows a lot from the hidden fortress. It hides it enough where you don't even realize that it's referencing it.
You know,
so that's why they get very close with these. They get very close to their reference, but they don't stay in it enough, and I'm glad they don't, to literally be a court episode because that would be bad and lame.
So as a fan, am I falling into a trap by comparing – real
the
world
best
situations
solution, Jimmy,
to
is if
these
they just
courtroom?
Never named it after a Hitchcock and everyone would be happy. And people that know Hitchcock would go, oh, it's a little bit the man who knew too much, rather than calling it the Jedi who knew too much and then forcing us to correlate it to the Hitchcock movie and the Hitchcock plot and all its beats and then say, well, Hitchcock did it in a much more deep and nuanced way. And, and Hitchcock did it in 2 hours and this is doing it in 22 minutes. So
perhaps the creators
– they ask for the unfair criticism by naming it. So they should have just liberated themselves, made it references to Hitchcock without having to call it a Hitchcock thing.
You're saying the creators of the show, by doing this, they're really painting themselves into a corner.
You don't need to do that. Right. Yeah, it's fun. And television, it's commonplace. You'll pick a season and you'll name a season after famous phrases or, you know, episodes on TV scripts. They always name them or like they're named after, you know, they'll pick a theme for a season. They'll just name them. It doesn't mean much. And only when you go on like Wikipedia and you look up the season of a show and you're like, oh, Homeland season 2, episode 6 was called this. You know, it's not like Star Wars. We do it because they have episode guides and do all this. So we analyze the titles and all this stuff. But
couldn't you argue that the reason that they may – well, one of the reasons that they may do that is because it's only a 20-minute show and they want you to hurry up and get the idea? You know, that it's kind of like, okay, this is where we're going.
Planting a seed.
They're trying to kind of throw the net wide and appeal to children and to adults. So, you know
– sure. Yeah.
Somebody might need a simple approach, you know, even though –
but I just had to liberate myself from directly correlating. I'm a big Hitchcock fan. And you could tell the person, Charles, who wrote this was a reverent and respectful Hitchcock fan – but it couldn't literally be a Hitchcock movie. It had to be Star Wars. And in the end, it had to serve as a bigger overarching plot and theme, which got back to Ahsoka and Anakin and their relation to the Jedi Temple and the Jedi's larger picture in the galaxy heading into episode 3. And these are things that Hitchcock and CSI don't have to factor in when they're plotting and scripting and –
Could it be you know, when you're talking about Ahsoka and you know the fact that she kind of gets thrown to the lions pretty easily? We know that the kind of dark side clouds everything and all that, you know, and we know that anger is part of the dark side, and that Anakin has been this enormous influence, both good and bad. So could it be that, you know, for the purposes of this story, her anger is throwing off the Jedi Master's ability to read her intent, you know, and that maybe she's giving them the wrong impression because that anger is within her, although it's kind of, you know, directed at frustration rather than at who they think is her target and who she's attacking and stuff like that. So they could just simply be confused because Anakin has taught her to keep that anger within her.
I mean, that it had to just – I mean, that's the problem with a show. Sometimes you just have to get through the beat and make characters accept it because you don't have that much time.
It does feel like the biggest hurdle to get over in this arc, isn't it? The fact that they're so ready to throw her to the lions. It's like that's the one thing that kind of is a bit of a trip up it, out of the all four episodes. You know, for me, I could buy it all. It's just that they seem so ready to just like bang. You know, after one incident, they're all ready to just kind of say, well, we can just ignore everything we know about Ahsoka because of this circumstantial evidence.
Well, see, I was led to believe that it's because they're trained to ignore their attachments. They're trained to...
That makes sense.
It almost is like, you know, treating people as if they're disposable in a way, which is the exact opposite of the compassion that the Jedi are supposed to live by. But that's what I assumed was the fact that this was a display of these Jedi Council Masters showing us as Star Wars fans that they are not attached to Ahsoka like we are. We look at her like she's our little sister.
They shouldn't be. That's their philosophy. You expect them to look at her balanced, and they actually chastise Anakin because he does want to make it personal.
Right.
They have to look at it as, look, this is symbolically bigger than – you have to look at it on a macro level beyond, yeah, we all like Ahsoka – but things are stacked against her. And if we don't move, it's something that will affect the entire order and our ability to do what's right on a greater level. And sometimes you have to make those small – it's almost like a decision in war. And we know the Jedi are okay with that. They're leading clones into battle. It's like organic life, flesh, living, breathing. Questionable if it has a soul. But they're okay to do that. And they do that for a greater good. And – that's the nobility, you know, that's the samurai aspect to them where they're able to make a sacrifice and look at something beyond the individual and the person. And yeah, is it cold that the council are doing that? Yes, but it's true to their beliefs. And does Palpatine know this when he presses Tarkin to go and push this to a trial? Absolutely, because that's how he plays them. He finds out what their weakness is, what their hang-up is, And then he forces them into the situation where they're exposed. That's what he does in the movies, and that's what he's always done in this series. He plays them, and they hang themselves by their own beliefs. This felt totally congruent with Jedi.
Do you guys feel that when you look at the movies, I mean, when Phantom Menace first came out, I remember thinking, right, this is us kind of seeing the Jedi at their peak. This is us kind of seeing them when they really were the guardians of peace and justice throughout the galaxy. But now I kind of feel that more and more over time, you know, as we kind of get more and more stories from Clone Wars, I kind of feel like we've never really truly seen them
at their peak.
When they were the guardians of peace and justice.
Right.
To me, it feels like they were already completely, like, going in the wrong direction at the start of Phantom Menace. They already didn't get it. They were kind of making mistakes and seeing things wrongly. And somehow the Jedi path already kind of felt polluted before we even got started.
Absolutely. They were complacent at the beginning of the prequel trilogy, thus setting up the pins for Palpatine to roll the ball down the lane and knock them all down. They were ripe to be manipulated and exploited. Their weaknesses were obvious at this point. They were bloated. They were trapped within, as Sidious himself says, trapped within their own pragmatic dogma and not seeing the big picture. So they were left vulnerable, and they were the perfect target to pick off by Palpatine. And so he created this war to suck them, to essentially suck the life out of them, to make them confused about their own faith that they've held so dear for so many years, to let go of the light and become attracted to the dark. Because what the dark side does is it plays on fear. Fear not only motivates the dark side and gives it the energy, fuels it, but it's also a weapon for the Sith to use. And Palpatine does this expertly with his manipulations behind the scene. And as long as we're talking about Ahsoka on trial, Tim Curry was brought in to take over for Ian Abercrombie as the voice of Palpatine. We got the Rocky Horror Palpatine show going on here. And I was just wondering what you guys thought about his performance, his debut performance. Paul, what did you think of Tim Curry as Palpatine?
I thought his Palpatine was less, you know, on character as Ian Abercrombie's amazing, you know, supernatural kind of performance. But I loved Tim Curry. And I think his Emperor will be Sidious will be amazing.
Right, right.
I can't, you know, I really hope we get a chance to see him kind of really just dial it up and go crazy.
How about you, Kyle?
I thought it was fine. It was good. Not enough to judge yet. I mean, he's got big shoes to fill, kind of stepping into this world that both Ians have now created. So it was hard to judge. I need to see the other side of him to know, you know, the extremes of his Palpatine. I need to see Palpatine and Sidious to kind of really judge. And that wasn't on display, so it's hard to know. But so, I think it was fine.
Yeah, okay. Well, so here's hearing more from him. We hope we get the opportunity in a future episode, if there are to be future episodes of Star Wars Clone Wars, and we'll be able to hear Tim Curry actually embody Sidious as well.
Was it B.J. Hughes?
No. He definitely does not get the B.J. Hughes Award. No, sir, he does not.
So, it was a safe incarnation, I would say.
So that's kind of a loose end, whether or not we'll actually see or hear Tim Curry voice the character of Palpatine in the guise of Sidious, or maybe it's the other way around. Sidious is in the guise of Palpatine.
Well, one more quick thing I just wanted to say.
Yeah.
Is, you know, in the prequels, the Sith always tell the truth.
Yeah.
And we hear Barriss, you know, at the end, just fully laying it out, telling the truth. She doesn't need to spin it. She doesn't need to lie. To justify her position, she tells the truth about the Jedi and what she sees. And maybe that's another indicator of if she's fallen or not. I don't know.
Is she dealing with absolutes when she makes a statement? The Jedi are now an army fighting for the dark side. Is she dealing with an absolute right there? I don't know. I think that's open to speculation. Well, I mean, we as fans know.
Who's in charge of the army?
We know that she's absolutely right. But does she believe that? I guess she does. I can see where you're coming from.
He's got Obi-Wan strung up and, you know, force binders, and he says, "What if I told you there was a Sith master in control of the Senate?" No. Yes. No. Yes, I just told you.
I told you.
He lays it right out. He tells
me. I've never thought about this before. The Sith always tell the truth.
The prequels and the Jedi tell the lies in the original trilogy.
This is so true.
From a certain point of view.
No, literally, the Sith always tell the truth.
Really? Dude, she's my sister? Oh, no. Yeah.
Okay, well, if they do, then what about Palpatine, his statement to Vader about what happened to Padme? Palpatine, a.k.a. Sidious, tells him, you killed her. But as people who know the Star Wars story,
Sith within Sith. That relationship is its own thing. I'm saying Sith with their enemy.
Sith on Sith, they'll lie. But okay, but you know what? From a certain point of view, Palpatine was absolutely correct. He did kill Padme. Anakin killed Padme. He broke her heart. And that's what
killed
her.
Neck.
Well, yeah, that too.
Okay. Regardless of how you die, you die.
And then, he was very liberal with his force choking in this story arc. And he did grab Asajj and give her a force choke and a physical choke with his hands. And it leads me to wonder, we're leaving Asajj on level 1313. And we've heard that the shelved live action show, the scripts are based in that Star Wars underworld environment on level 1313. Do you think that there's a possibility that Asajj Ventress exists within the pages of those scripts of that shelved television show? Maybe it'll actually see the light of day, and maybe we'll see live action Asajj doing her thing on level 1313. Is there a possibility that could happen, Paul?
Wow, that would be fantastic. That would ramp it up a gear for me, I think. I mean, everything I've heard about 1313 sounds like it would be an interesting show, but I don't necessarily associate it with anybody who has a lightsaber. So I think Asajj may have been a much needed, kind of lightsaber wielding element that you're not going to get from somewhere else.
Ah, so. But she does not have her sabers anymore.
She could make one.
She could just whip one up.
She could steal one. But Asajj is such a fantastic character there. And I know you and Jason can banter back and forth about whether or not she switched sides. Yeah. I think she has. I think that the best evidence we've had so far for this is I was reminded of the Clone Wars movie in when she was fighting Anakin and thinking, didn't she kind of force choke? Was it Rex or one of the clone troopers up against the wall of the hut hangout? She just kind of walked in and force choked him from a distance, mm-hmm. and up he slid up the wall. And yet when Anakin was kind of getting choky in the episode with her, she didn't retaliate. She just kind of, let it happen. And she had an opportunity to strike back in that way, and she didn't go there. I mean, you could argue that she just, knew that she couldn't beat him in that kind of a face-off. But
I think that's just it. It's a testimony to the power Anakin Skywalker has. An Asajj Ventress cannot best Anakin Skywalker when it comes to force abilities. There's a block he can use or something. I'm really not sure how all that works.
Scary in these episodes, though, wasn't it? I thought, as soon as he decided, right, I'm going to go and sort the situation out, I definitely felt, right, that's Darth Vader now. Mm-hmm. Demanding everything and just walking in the room with a complete kind of command, complete authority about him. I mean, it's fantastic that they managed to kind of put across, this is Vader with that character, because I mean, you look at his face and you just kind of think, really, that's Vader, with everything that you were used to before the prequels. It's kind of hard to see Vader's mask, around that face, but in this show, I think they certainly pulled it off. I think a lot of the time in these episodes, I was definitely thinking that's Darth Vader now. That's, even though you could argue technically it's not, but physically it felt like the same guy.
How about when he grabbed Barriss's saber and he was sort of studying it? It reminded me of Vader looking at Luke's saber on.
Oh yeah, I was going to say that.
Yeah,
you guys.
I knew that.
I love the trap he sets. Mm-hmm. By igniting the saber and swinging it at her.
Yeah,
instinct is going to force her hand into revealing her intentions. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Where'd she have those sabers of Ventress's? She had them in like a spittoon there in the corner. I didn't know Barriss was dipping and spitting, but so then the big battle breaks out between Anakin and Barriss. Again, the choreography and animation, the Clone Wars crew deserves an award just for these saber duels we've been seeing in the last couple of arcs. We saw a great duel between Pre Vizsla and Darth Maul. And then we saw a great duel between Darth Maul, Savage, and Sidious. And now we've moved to this one, Anakin versus Barriss. It's really film realistic, just extremely well choreographed. It felt very real. Did you guys notice the Jedi younglings?
The Jedi younglings and Tara Sanube.
And Tara Sanube.
I was like, whoa, they're throwing in all these fan favorites too into this finale?
Yeah, yeah. And Petro, who was in the younglings arc, and who, we wrote him off as being this cocky, overconfident, kind of a brat at the beginning of that story arc. We watched him grow through that entire young Jedi arc and into somebody who was formidable and trustworthy and reliable. And here again, we see that coming into play in his one line of dialogue. Look out. He saved Anakin Skywalker's life. Anakin was down on the ground, face down on the ground, and Barriss was coming down. She had the high ground, and you know how important that is in Star Wars. And she was jumping down onto him with the saber lit. Leave it to Petro to actually save Anakin Skywalker's life. He alerted him, and
Petro's
Anakin
cool.
Spun around. Petro is cool.
Tara Sanube has a white saber.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Now, what's up with that? Is that like a training saber, or you know, we saw
he
the
uses
yellow
a white
sabers.
Saber when he fights Cassie Cryer too, doesn't he?
Does he? I see. Yeah. Wow. Now, see, I got to go back and watch that one.
But here's what I, you know, one thing is what I love about the show. What I love the Jedi Children arc. It was good to see them again. I mean, Ahsoka's a character who, right when she got involved, she graduated. She was like a freshman who started playing with the varsity. We never got to see her acclimate and step into, like, grow through being a young Jedi. She just went right off with the greatest Jedi in the galaxy.
Yeah.
And I love the Jedi kids arc. Again, I gotta mention it. You know, there's still room in the Star Wars universe to follow a young person through their growth as a Jedi. I mean, look, Anakin gets involved in the Order. He's like, you're going to be a Jedi Knight. And we skip ahead and we never see what he goes through in those years. We've still never seen, really, outside of that scene, what Jedi kids do in the temple other than go to the map room with Yoda and talk about star charts or that, training in the courtyard by the big tree.
Right.
I mean, that's like one of two instances we've ever seen Jedi doing what do they do at school? What do you learn at Jedi school? How have we never seen this? I still don't know why we haven't seen this yet. Hopefully we do in future seasons. Maybe the Jedi kids come back. Maybe we see them as they're moving up through the ranks. And how do you educate a Jedi? How do you train it? And it's not demystifying. It's actually magical. It's empowering. I think it's inspiring. I love those episodes. And so I still think there's room to show that in this series.
Well, we'll see if
I want to see more of those kids.
Yeah, I think a lot of fans would agree with you.
More Tara Sanube.
Yeah.
While we're in the kind of process of potentially massively overanalyzing, but this is kind of what we do.
That's what we do. Yeah, right.
You know, when they were in the courtyard and the younglings were getting trained and what have you, I noticed that the tree had kind of golden lines running all the way around it, which for me immediately kind of called up the Enid with the golden bow. And the golden bow in the Enid is basically the kind of the guardian of the threshold of hell. So the message there being, you know, that whole saying about the path to hell is paved with good intentions and all that. And it seemed very appropriate that land when it did. You know, the fact that, you know, maybe Barriss, you know, had good intentions, but it was all going to go really wrong for her. And the same was true of Anakin and Ahsoka. So although that might be me totally over reading into it, at the same time I kind of thought, well, that's kind of funny that should land when it did.
You know? I just thought it was interesting that there was a tree on Coruscant. It kind of made me think of that great Ralph McQuarrie painting of the entertainment district on Coruscant, which we actually saw in the Clone Wars going back a couple seasons. But in the entertainment district, there is a rock protruding from the pavement. And what the rock actually is the top of a mountain peak, and people can come by and actually touch Coruscant Earth in that courtyard there. Paul, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Didn't they change it to Big Rock in the episode of Clone Wars that it was in? they made it the Big Rock from Big Rock Studios.
Oh, they. That's the big rock there on Lucas Valley Road. Yeah. I didn't notice that.
They did, yeah. It's, I think it was in the trivia for that week. I think it mentioned it.
This is the Big Rock. All right, guys. Well, let's get to the big moment here. This is where not only the story arc was leading us to, but, I mean, really the entire series was taking us to this moment. It's the question we've been asking pretty much since before this show even went on the air. What happens to Ahsoka? We don't see her in episode 3. There's no mention of Anakin's Padawan anywhere in episode 3. She had to go somewhere. Something must have happened to her. A lot of us assume she died, but she had the opportunity. Her name was cleared. She had the opportunity to come back into the fold, to be brought back into the Jedi Order, and she says, thanks, but no thanks. Number one, I don't think the Jedi Council ever looked worse. I really think that they had egg on their face, and yet they still were able to maintain this arrogant veil of pompousness, and, you know, by assuming that what Ahsoka had gone through was her personal trial on the road to becoming a fully fledged Jedi Knight. For starters, that was a revelation to me, because I had always wondered, because we've never really had any clear definition on what a Jedi trial actually is. We finally get something of a clear definition of the fact that it's different for each Jedi. It's a personal journey, and it's not something that they go to. It's not a test, a standardized test that they take, but it's all part of the journey of becoming a Jedi. You have to cross this threshold in your life at some point, and it's a life-changing moment that's going to put you on a certain path and prove to your peers that you have achieved this higher status as far as being a Jedi is concerned. So they determined that that was her trial, and now she had passed, apparently, with flying colors. So I was led to believe that should Ahsoka choose to return to the Jedi Order, they would have knighted her. She would have lost her Padawan status and become a fully fledged Jedi Knight. But that even comes into question in that scene alone, because Anakin hands her Padawan beads, which is the equivalent of having the hair braid. Obviously, Ahsoka doesn't have hair, so the thing that sort of symbolized her status as a Padawan were those beads that were hanging off the back of her head. Anakin offered them as a gesture to her. Now, it could be looked at it in a couple of different ways. Would it be like, here, take this. This is symbolic of you returning to the Order. Or take this. This is symbolic of you returning to the Order and becoming my Padawan once again. Where do you guys think it would have gone if Ahsoka returned to the Order? Would she have been knighted? Kyle?
I think he was saying, take this. You've never washed them. Take them back. No, I think it was just symbolic. She would have graduated. They discussed that as the trial. It was a symbolic gesture, and obviously either way, at the end of this episode, she either would have, I think, moved on to become a knight, or she would have left the Order. So either way, it needed to be a step forward for her character. And instead of taking the next step deeper into it, rather than just being the same, it was the next step deeper is what it felt like. Come back and be a knight. Now be one of us. Get closer to the position we're in. Or she rejects it and follows, maybe not even her heart, but I don't know. I mean, it was a little bit of heart, a little bit mind, you know. I'm sure she was torn, but without being sentimental, she had to pick what she felt was truest to her beliefs.
Yeah, that's
symbolic. Yeah, I think
it was more of a symbolic gesture. Paul, what do you think would have happened to Ahsoka should she had returned to the Jedi Order?
I think the first thing I thought of with that scene was, so if she had a braid, would that like real tough looking god have yanked her hair out? Because he just pulled it off her head. I felt like slapping him upside the face.
It was Velcro.
That you mean, yeah. But so that was the first thing. It was like, really? Is that what they do? They just yank it off your head.
It's very cold.
And then afterwards, I kind of thought, well, I don't blame her just for being miffed if for nothing else but that. And I mean, they were just so like unreasonable with her and so unpleasant with her. I mean, I really couldn't blame her for going back. But I felt as though they made it quite clear that, I mean, surely isn't the Jedi trial essentially just a precursor to getting knighted? I mean, isn't that the final step?
Well, you would assume just from the line that Obi-Wan Kenobi had in The Phantom Menace, he was very eager to take the trials, which led me to believe that it was more of a standardized thing up until now.
However, she is very young. And I mean, if you look at Obi-Wan and you look at Anakin, you know, it does seem like that might have been a bit premature. So I think it's difficult to say. I mean, it felt to me as if they realized that they'd made a massive mistake and they thought, well, we need to, you know, do something to make up for that. And it better be a huge gesture. So it's like, well, she's a good kid. You know, maybe she's been through enough and, you know, we can kind of iron out the creases once she's in, you know?
Yeah.
I think they knew she was, you know, she must have felt like righteously indignant about the whole thing and ready to walk. But I mean, I just felt that whole scene was so incredibly moving, you know, for a bunch of cartoon characters, essentially, you know, to have an effect on you that way. I mean, even without the music, you know, it was just to look at it, you know, it just, oh, you cared so much for Ahsoka, didn't you? And I know you were saying about her being like a little sister, but you really wanted her to make the right decision. The thing that I also thought of was, it's slightly, you know, I wonder if Ahsoka plays now a part in the continuation of the Jedi Order. I mean, we realize that there are people who kind of carry on, like in terms of, you know, we know that Luke Skywalker is going to be there in the future and that Yoda survives, although in a slightly crazy state on a mud moon. you know, I mean, at the same time, perhaps Ahsoka's out there, you know, teaching her version of Jedi Knights for them to rematerialize by episode 7. You know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because otherwise it's going to be pretty, you know, devoid of Jedi Knights by episode 7, isn't it? Because all we've got is Luke. And 30 years on, I guess he's not going to have had much of a chance to train up heaps of other Jedi. So, but that's kind of getting ahead of things. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I think if she'd got back, I think they would have made her a Jedi Knight.
Yeah, I do too. So then she leaves, and the Jedi let Ahsoka walk away. But Anakin runs out after her, as he should, as any good master would do for his Padawan. And this is when, to me, the whole series reached its climax. Because, to me, the Clone Wars is told from the perspective of Ahsoka Tano. And I have difficulty imagining the series moving forward without her. Not saying I don't want to see it happen. I want to see it brought closer to Revenge of the Sith. And I want to see the fallout of this take place. And I would like to see Ahsoka out there on her own. Maybe there are more stories to tell as far as that goes. But Anakin fails in convincing her to stay with the Jedi Order. So, Kyle, I'm going to start with you. Very simple question. Did Ahsoka make the right choice?
Well, it depends. Were they going to throw her a pizza party if she came back? Or was this just like, come back, no pomp and circumstance? So if there's a party involved, then she probably made the wrong choice.
Anything for a party.
Jedi party. Graduation. Maybe there's a dance. No, she made the right choice.
Yeah.
At least the right choice, I think, for to make this show dramatically interesting. Did you want her to stay? I mean, that's always a good choice. Is like, you know, she made a choice that was true to her beliefs, but it was a hard choice, and you'd wish she could have stayed, but you know that she couldn't. So then you know it's probably the right thing, and they didn't take an easy out. So I feel like they did justice to her character, and they made her make a hard choice. It sends shockwaves to the show. I mean, future seasons, it's going to be interesting to see what they do and how they balance. Obviously, she's not going to disappear. It's not like they're writing her off.
Or are they?
I don't think so.
Where does Ahsoka go? When she reaches the bottom step of the Jedi Temple and she's now on the streets of Coruscant, Paul, where does Ahsoka go?
To the pub.
Yes, of course. Go get a drink. Now, Ashley said she would go out for ice cream and cupcakes.
I think I'm glad. If this is the very last time we see Ahsoka, I'm glad that she's alive, because I would have been very sad to see Ahsoka die. And I don't think that would have been the right fate for this character. I think it would have been maybe a little pointless. You know, I think it's nice that, things are left a little up in the air, and that, we can all kind of, we can all draw some kind of comfort about the character from the fact that she's not there during the purge, which means she may have escaped the purge and all that kind of thing. But as for where she goes, I don't see her kind of shacking up with a guy or anything like that. I genuinely feel as though she's a kind of character that maybe certainly needs to spend some time alone, you know, having been surrounded by all these people telling her what to think and what's okay and what's not, and being in the heart of this conflict. Maybe she needs a little kind of Yoda time. She needs to go away to some remote planet to just kind of go and think about things. But I personally always felt that Ahsoka was too large a character, despite, you know, her small demeanor, to just have a small send-off. I kind of felt as though, although this is pretty kind of spectacular in terms of, you know, the last few episodes have been a real, you know, spectacle to watch, I kind of feel in terms of kind of universal importance, the way this kind of story wraps up is not the big finale I expected for Ahsoka. I thought that she would definitely play some larger part in the kind of the whole kind of cosmic balance, as I said earlier, you know. So I'm not sure where she's going, but I feel as though it's just kind of a holding point until she gets an even larger finale, you know, and that one too, I hope that she survives.
Yeah.
You know, she plays a bigger part in the larger story. I would like to feel as though things kind of in by the time we get to Return of the Jedi, that maybe things could not have worked out the way they worked out without her. You know?
Wow, well, so she was like a linchpin in many ways. She was a necessary fulcrum for everything to work the way it was supposed to work.
That would be nice. I mean, I feel as though lots of things in the Clone Wars, for me, make the prequels work. You know, in a way that I wasn't able to kind of, you know, manufacture for myself. I feel as though it now makes a lot more sense as a result. And I think it would be a lovely way to kind of wrap up the whole Clone Wars if, you know, it just kind of provided that connective tissue right through to the end of the saga. You know, she had some connection to Jedi.
But if this is the wrap up to the Clone Wars, do you think this is suitable? Do you feel fulfilled as a fan? Do you feel like you've gotten everything you can get out of this series? Obviously, we always want more. But, Kyle, do you feel like this would be a suitable ending for the Clone Wars if this is actually it?
No, I think it's a ending. I don't think it's the best ending. Yeah, I guess it could be suitable, and you could say it didn't leave like with a big cliffhanger. Yeah, we want to know what happened to her. But you also said, what could she go do now?
Mm-hmm.
Look, she has this outstanding relationship with Lux.
Right.
She's developed this new understanding and commonality with Ventress. Anakin still, whenever the council won't let him leave or pursue something he's feeling, he's going to be, Snips, I need your help. You know what I mean? It's not like she's saying, never talk to me again. At some point, they're going to cross paths again, and maybe I think she's going to be like a wandering samurai.
It's sort of a man with no name.
Yeah, I mean, do you ever read the Dark Jedi comic, which I think is really well done? It's in a different time period, but I think they're setting her up that she can go off and do her own thing. She has obviously a very strong moral compass and code. She's been trained well. She's been raised well. She has a good head on her shoulders. She's completely capable, agile, swift thinker. She has a good heart. So she's the main character of the series. She's not going to go anywhere. She's going to go do her own thing. And you're just going to see, just the way all of a sudden we're like, how could there be more Sith? Well, they brought in more Sith, and everybody overlapped. And we had Ventress and Savage and Maul and Dooku and Sidious. And it'll work itself out. And she's not necessarily going to be going back to the temple and taking orders from people she doesn't believe in her. But doesn't mean she's not going to go do what's right and help people in need. As we saw that in the middle of her arc, you know, this one, she tries to help the little kid in an elevator. She's always, her instinct is to help
right.
and do good.
Don't you think that there are so many unresolved questions that Ahsoka has to play some part in its resolution?
She has
to. In fact, we have no idea what happens to Maul. We have no idea what happens to Asajj. And many of the characters, you know, it just feels to me like she
honestly,
has...
Anakin Skywalker's first test in his suit should be, now prove to me you're really...
Ooh, that's dope.
I need you to go take out your former Padawan. Oh. She's still alive.
Wow. Now, see, that would be
some drama, dog. Yes.
That would be some drama, no question about it.
Who knows if we'll ever see that, but, I mean, that's what I always wanted this series to be anyway. Or, you know what, she could still die. She doesn't have to die right now. It's interesting that Dave's probably talking about George wanting her to die, him wanting her to live. The bottom line is I don't see a bad thing. I talked before about things happening in threes and loss. And this is one form of loss. But the other form of loss, which she does need to be a loss for Anakin. She can't be a minor victory. The loss could come in the form, look, you have Maul. He's still alive. He ain't dead. Mm. How is Darth Sidious going to deal with that dangling participle? He can either go, say, you mothball him so he's alive during the episode 7 time as a failsafe, or he can go be like, you go take out. I want to seal his turn to the dark side. I want to seal his pain and anger and hate. You go take out Ahsoka, who he has a relationship with, and he's going to go kill you. And I just kill two birds with one stone and pave the way for you to take over. And now you're filled with rage, so you cut down him, and now he's gone, and I've got rid of this girl who's been a pain in my ass for the past 3 seasons because she's off doing her own thing, and I can't monitor her because she's no longer a Jedi. Boom, there's some drama.
It would be interesting to see Ahsoka become something of a Jedi vigilante.
Easy.
You know?
Right now, they finally have a cool, open, blank slate with this character. Now she's liberated. Now she doesn't have to fit into Jedi plot.
Here's a question I have. Now, we're all aware of the fact that even right up to this point that there are episodes from the season that were nudged into season 6. And we know that this has been a common issue with the Clone Wars, where things have been moved around for, you know, very smart, sensible, kind of thought out reasons in terms of pacing and what have you. Do we know for a fact that this was always the plan for Ahsoka at the end of this season? Or is this something that was bumped up from season 6 in terms of kind of like, all right, this may be the end of the road. We better kind of resolve Ahsoka's tale.
You know, that's an interesting question.
Babylon 5 and the way they thought they were ending at 4 seasons and ended it with 5.
Babylon what?
It was a good show, don't knock it.
But see, like, Paul, they
crammed it all into one season, and then the next season was kind of a little grey. I mean, this couldn't be the same scenario, could it?
Paul, you raise an interesting question here, the timing of this. Because we assumed that, without question, Ahsoka's story would be wrapped up when the series actually gets wrapped up. And we still have a lot of question marks about the Clone Wars as a television show. We don't know if it's going to continue. There's no deal in place. There's been production going forward on seasons 6, 7, and 8 without a deal in place. So this is kind of some weird uncharted territory we're getting into here, because we don't know if there actually is going to be a season 6 or if just remaining episodes that have unaired, they're just going to be released online somehow in some way. We don't know what's going to happen, or if it's going to be a directed disc release. Who knows? I think it's very important that the show continues as a viable television series that can continue to grow and evolve. And I think that's the key thing. That's why I'm asking people to write to Bob Iger. But the timing of this is interesting, because it also times out with George stepping away from Lucasfilm. Yeah. And we know George was very involved with the storyline of Ahsoka Tano as she existed with the Jedi during the period of the Clone Wars. And now George is walking away. So is that what makes it an appropriate time to wrap up Ahsoka's story? Because George is walking away. Or is it because this is the end of the series? Or is it because this is just when it's supposed to happen? I always believe that the Clone Wars were told from the perspective of Ahsoka Tano. And I said this earlier in the show. So it presents an interesting direction for the show to move into now. Now we've seen essentially the seeds of the Empire in business. We've seen Tarkin extending his slimy reach. We've seen very Death Star-like environments, very imperial environments. And, you know, Palpatine's got the Red Guards now. So we definitely are getting closer to the end of the Republic. There's no question about that. So, the timing of this release, the timing of having Ahsoka lose her innocence, essentially, and being cast aside at a point where she was at in her Jedi career, where she should have become a Jedi Knight, but instead she finds herself out on the streets with no family anymore. What do you think, Kyle, about the timing of this episode in relation to the Clone Wars mythology on a whole?
Well, even if you look back at when these episodes were written and also drawn, look at the concept art when it's dated, this predates the Disney and George's decision. And we also know that George and Dave, they've openly discussed how they mapped out the show and where it's going. So I don't think that's in time with his retirement. And I think, you know, we're just getting deeper into the drama. And I think Dave has his marching orders and they've kind of collaborated on where the show's going to go. And he knows what he'd need to do, even if George is not there on a daily basis. I've heard he's still hanging around and stuff. That's the rumor. He still loves this show. I don't know how it's changed, but I've heard there's been some GL sightings up and about. It's not like he's like, you know, later I'm going to Disney World. No, he still cares. So who knows? I don't know. I mean,
could it be because Ahsoka, you know, if Ahsoka stayed as a main kind of character thread throughout the entirety of the Clone Wars and until the point it got to the point where we're buffering right up against Revenge of the Sith, then I would say that she's still in like incredible danger of getting lynched by the Emperor's lackeys. Even if she just got booted out of the Jedi Order. Whereas if you know, it was a couple of seasons before the end when she kind of leaves, you do genuinely feel as if she's gotten away with it, that she's not going to, you know, she's not going to come into the firing line. So I think maybe that could be a motivation too.
All right. Well, guys, it's been a wild ride. It's been a wild season. And that's going to do it for Clone Wars Declassified for Season 5. All right, be sure to join us next week on Rebel Force Radio when we will be having Dave Filoni himself, supervising director of Star Wars The Clone Wars. Dave will be joining us for our post-season wrap-up show. I'm sure we'll have a lot of questions were generated in this discussion tonight with you two guys. I'm going to try to follow up on as many of these loose threads with Filoni next week. And I want to recommend to all of our listeners to be sure to leave us questions you might have for Dave on the Rebel Force Radio Facebook page, or go ahead and email us show@rebelforceradio.com with your questions for Dave Filoni. And
Jimmy, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I'll change my voice and call in. Am I allowed to ask Dave a question?
Sure, you most certainly can. People have been known to do that from time to time.
And if I change it a couple times, can I call multiple?
Yes, you can. Very good, very good. And you know, we want Season 6 to come around, Kyle, so we get your Clone Wars acting debut.
That's right.
We haven't forgotten about that. So
you can never forget.
Never forget.
Hold up your four fingers and never forget. That's what we missed this season, guys. Ben Quadraneros was on a poster.
Yep.
You realize that got pushed for no good reason? And Pablo says he's going to write an article on why things got moved around. And I think there's something today I read where there's like ties better dramatically. But if we never get to see a poster of Ben Quadraneros, Jimmy, I'm gonna have to restart the campaign.
Bring it back. Well, has the campaign ever died? I don't think so.
I think folks that are out there who are writing in need to, you know, I mean, I know that film business these days is often about demographics and who's watching. I think when you write into Bob Iger, you know, and you know, politely express your passion for the Clone Wars, remind him that your entire family probably loves it as much as you do. You know, the little kids right through to the older people, the older fans, you know, it's like it appeals to everybody, which is a very, very rare thing and a precious thing.
And before I let you guys go, I just am going to ask you for your final thoughts. Kyle, I the main thing I want to know is, how did you feel emotionally at the big wrap-up, the last minute of this episode? There were a lot of people out there saying that they openly wept. We were hearing that it was a tearjerker moment before the episode ever aired. But yes, you thought it was powerful.
Powerful, it was challenging, it was brave, asked new questions, sends characters in new directions. It gave the show a good shake-up for the future. But I felt it was justified, it was honest, it was touching. I loved it. I mean, and we see that Anakin Kenan will leave the Order because someone he respects already has. You know, he admits that sometime he wants to. So I thought that was all powerful, prophetic. I mean, the Council's failures, clear failures with Ahsoka, paves the way for her, for Anakin to take the same path in Revenge of the Sith. And he's not even the trailblazer we thought he was. You know, Ahsoka, in a strange and alternate way, did it before him. Someone he respects did it in her own way. So he knows it's okay. And I think this was in a lot of ways like an act one for Revenge of the Sith. If we see more and Disney announces where they put it, great. But if not, this is still a worthy act one for what leads into Revenge of the Sith. And I think overall, you know, just deep performances by Ashley and by Matt Lanter. I thought character, nuance, the final line, you know, growth, liberated, sad. I think it had it all.
Had it all. Well, Kyle, it was great to talk to you about this amazing, historic episode of Star Wars The Clone Wars. If people want to get a hold of you, they can follow you on Twitter. They can like you on Facebook. You're everywhere. You're very active with social media. So we'll be looking forward to hearing your voice back here on Rebel Force Radio. Whether or not Clone Wars Declassified continues, we'll still have you back, I'm sure, many, many, many times.
I'll be back regardless. People, be vocal. Also, check out the Facebook Smuggler's Gambit page that Jimmy set up. And right now on my Facebook fan page, started a little debate. What's the worst EU and what's the best EU? So there go, you chime in. I'm having a little bit of fun seeing what people think. But this, like I said, historic is the best word. You chose it. And I think this was a historic episode.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Final thoughts, Paul Bateman.
I think there's a lot of pressure when you say final thoughts for an episode like this, because these may be our very, very final thoughts. I kind of feel as though we all feel very lucky to be Star Wars fans, I'm sure, and we all feel very lucky to have kind of been, you know, be alive when all these fantastic Star Wars movies are out there. I feel as though this TV series has evolved into a way that I didn't anticipate. It's evolved into genuinely real Star Wars. It's evolved into something that makes me feel like I felt the first time I saw the Death Star blow up. It makes me feel like standing up and cheering when an episode really kind of finishes like some of these episodes finished. It moves me incredibly. Many of these animated characters have become very kind of dear to me, and I'll miss them a great deal when they do finally pull down the curtain on the Clone Wars. I realise how precious this show is in terms of, you know, what else is out there. I can't recall the last time when I've actually kind of felt so much respect for a TV show, be it animated or otherwise. I think for the type of show that it is, especially, it's to be applauded, because this really is, I know Kyle has said this himself before, this really is cinematic quality animation. It's also cinematically, you know, quality writing and performances. This show deserves to cost 10 times what it costs, you know, in terms of the production values that we're getting. What's out there is definitely worth watching, and it's definitely worth our respect. And I think when it first started out, I think a lot of people were very doubtful that this show could amount to much. People kind of, you know, pushed against the look, and a few people pushed against Ahsoka when they first encountered the character. But I feel that 90% of Star Wars fans now, I guess maybe you can give me a more realistic appraisal of this, Jimmy, but most of the Star Wars fans that I know adore the Clone Wars. And I think that that has to be noticed by Disney, and I really, really do hope that they give this show the respect that it so readily deserves. And as I said before, I think my closer would just simply be that a show doesn't get this good because you throw money at it. A show gets this good because you've got the right people involved and everybody cares and puts their heart and soul into it. And for me, it's visible from the first frame to the last that this show is just excellent. So long may it continue, and I very, very much hope that this season is not the final one.
Absolutely, Paul. Very well said. Very well said. Amazing acting, amazing animation. Big thanks to the cast and crew of Star Wars The Clone Wars for providing us with such great entertainment this season and all the previous seasons. Kevin Kiner's soundtrack in this episode was absolutely outstanding. If there's ever been a need for a new Star Wars soundtrack purchase to be made by myself, it would be this episode. I thought it was great. More than a couple subtle nods to the iconic soundtrack work of John Williams, and which you always say, Paul, is the oxygen of Star Wars, and we got that in some heavy doses in this episode. Very heavy ending for me. I've seen it probably 6 times now, and while I'm not weeping, I do feel sort of a little bit of a lump in the throat, and maybe a small punch to the stomach when Ahsoka's walking away. And the animators created so much emotion, and the combination between the animation and the lighting and the acting and the music, it just really, really set the bar up even higher than it's been set by these incredibly talented creators of this show. So my final thoughts simply are, thank you, Dave Filoni, and the core group of actors that have worked on this show for all these years. Matt Lanter, James Arnold Taylor, Ashley Eckstein, Catherine Tabor, Corey Burton, Sam Witwer. The list just goes on and on. Phil Lamar. You guys have all just been fantastic. Steven Stanton. I'm forgetting some names here. I almost feel like I'm winning an award and the music is going to start, is going to rise up and play me off. So before that happens, thanks again for an incredible ride. We certainly hope it continues, and we really want to encourage fans of Star Wars The Clone Wars to raise your voice and let Disney know that this is a very important show to us fans and to our families, and it's a great form of entertainment. It's a form of entertainment that needs to continue on broadcast television, and it needs to go all the way. There's still potential in this show. For as far as it has come, we think it can go even further. So save the Clone Wars, raise your voice, and let the decision makers know you want this show to continue. Nuke Gunray, not in this episode. Nuke Gunray, not in this season. Nuke Gunray hasn't been in any episodes for a long time. So thank you, everyone, so much for going on this ride with us. For Kyle Newman, Paul Bateman, and Jason Swank. Jason, we missed you.
We do.
For Rebel Force Radio, I'm Jimmy Mack. And remember,
the Force will be with you always.